in every age and in every individual life that is going to be lived upon the earth. There's not going to be one time, but multiple times in life that the clouds of pain, the clouds of trial and difficulty are going to roll in. And they're not only going to obscure, perhaps at times, joy and happiness that we might otherwise experience, they have the tendency to obscure God Himself. And so from the time that man has existed until the sophistication of the common age, the problem of pain continues to rear its head, and men wonder about themselves, and they wonder about God, and they wonder about the meaning and the nature of life itself, especially when in the midst of pain and trial. Perhaps in one sense, the problem can even be more difficult for those who believe in God, because we also believe in God as He reveals Himself in the Scriptures, and that is that He is a loving and a benevolent and a gracious God. And so the question that pain raises in our minds is, if He is all of that, and He loves me as He says He does, why am I going through this? And what is the deeper purpose of what I'm enduring? And oftentimes that's really where the difficulty in pain lies, is the question of why and what is the reason and what is the purpose. This is a question that has been asked since the dawn of mankind, and it's not going to be answered by me in 30 or 40 minutes. And we have touched on this particular issue in some of my lessons in the past. I know David has touched on it, and even some others have as well. But specifically, I would like to come back and address this issue from the standpoint of the book of Hebrews and what is particularly pointed out about God in the book of Hebrews chapter 12. So if you have a New Testament, would you turn, not now to Hebrews 12, but to Hebrews 10. That's page 809 in the Pew Bible. Hebrews, the 10th chapter. We read about the present suffering of these people who are Jewish in their heritage, in their culture, but they have been introduced to Christ and they have embraced Christ. They have become followers of Him or Christians. And one might think that God would reward in every way a person who would abandon their heritage and culture, their ties with their ancestry, to leave all and sacrifice all in order to embrace Him, that He would just bestow every kind of richness and blessing to be imagined, remove from them all trials and tribulations and all difficulties as a reward for their choosing Him. And it was very difficult for Jews who made this choice in the first century, as it is even today. These people are rejected by their families and by their cultures, and their economic hardships that are brought to bear upon them, and they are expelled from their culture. And in Hebrews chapter 10, we find a glimpse in verses 32 through 34 of what resulted after they became Christians. He says, "Recall the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven." So in writing to these people who have abandoned all for the sake of the Lord and have gladly embraced Him, he goes back to review their early days of their conversion. And he says, "Do you remember what you have endured? Do you remember the plundering of your goods and your glad and willing association with others who were imprisoned or otherwise persecuted for the sake of the Lord?" Why is he reminding them of this? because they're beginning to slip away from the faith. They are wrestling with these questions of, why me, Lord? Why the pain and why the difficulty? After all I've given to you and after all I've endured, why am I suffering these things? And looking in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, and verse 3, and we'll speak more directly to this in just a few minutes, but he says, consider him, that's Jesus, consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Verses 12 and 13, therefore strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. The picture that he's drawing of these people are people that are burdened under the oppressiveness of their suffering. In verse 3, they are in danger, severe danger, immediate danger, of becoming weary and discouraged. And then he pictures their feeble knees, their buckling knees, and their hands are hanging down. And, you know, you can see this in an athlete. When a man is competing and he's near the lead in whatever he's doing, he's got a spring in his step and he's standing upright and he's active in his motions, and you can see confidence. And then let him strike out two or three times, or let him make a bogey or two, or let the tide of the match begin to turn against him, and you can see it. Suddenly he's walking like this, and he's slow and ponderous, and he's not up and springy and active and energetic anymore. And that's the way these people are spiritually. They're dragging. They're bent over. They're discouraged and they're despondent, and it's because they're wrestling with this question of why? Why me? Essentially, I think what the author is trying to get them to see throughout the book of Hebrews is they've let their circumstances obscure God Himself. And this is the danger that we face in times of trial and tribulation, that we begin to let those circumstances reflect on, if not the goodness of God, the wisdom of God, or the knowledge of God. Don't you know what's happening to me? Don't you see what's going on here? How could you let me go through this? It's almost like the prophets of Baal, you know, speaking to Elijah, or Elijah speaking to them as regarding their gods. Well, call on your gods. Maybe they're away for a while. Maybe they're busy doing something else. And we might think that's our God. He must not be aware of what's happening to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't be going through this. And so, the circumstance, as Satan agitates it, begins to reflect on God. And so, throughout the book of Hebrews, this is addressed. That is the faithfulness of God. Go back to chapter 6 and verse 10. He says, God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you have shown toward His name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. And in chapter 10, as we just read, some of that ministry was done to those in prison because of their faith. And look what he says in verse 10 here of chapter 6. God is not unjust. Why does he say that? Unless they've begun to think that God is unjust. After all I've done, after all I've given up, and now here I am going through this, I don't think that's right. James alluded to that in his talk before the Lord's Supper. It's not fair for me to be going through this. And furthermore, it's not fair that you're letting me go through this. And so he's writing to strengthen them. And in fact, throughout the remainder there of chapter 6, he talks about the oath that God makes on top of the promises. And then he affirms in verse 18 of chapter 6, it's impossible for God to lie. He's not unjust to forget what we commit to Him. And He does not lie about the promises that are ours as His people. And so he's trying to bring these people back to a proper understanding of God Himself. Chapter 10 and verse 23. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for He who promised is faithful. There He is again, addressing the character of God, the faithfulness of God. In chapter 11 and in verse 6, without faith it is impossible to please Him, for he who comes to God must believe that He is and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. Tie that back with 6:10 that we just read. God is not unjust to forget your labor and what you have devoted unto Him. So trying to persuade these people that the course of action they're taking, that is to depart from God and leave Him because of the hardships that they're facing, he's trying to persuade them, that's not right. You need to turn around and come back to God and have confidence and faith in Him is the main thrust of this book. Everything that God has done for us through Christ is far superior and in fact is the only substantive thing that provides a relationship with Him. Judaism does not. It cannot. And it is spiritual suicide to try to go back to that covenant and that law. Trust God. Have confidence in God. Wait a minute. How do I do that when I'm going through all of this suffering? Well, coming to chapter 11, he lists numerous heroes of the Jews' ancestry. In fact, predating their father, Abraham, going back to the patriarchal age. But in Hebrews 11, we find the writer going into the examples of other people, the examples specifically of their heritage, and trying to make several points about faith. But one of the main points that he makes is, it's always been true that those who walk by faith do so through difficulty. They endure through their own storms and through their own trials, through their own pain and their own tribulation. And it's by obedient, enduring, sacrificial faith in God that their ancestors overcame and that they too will overcome if they do not renege on their faith and reject and abandon God. He speaks of Abel, for example, in chapter 11. He says, Abel was not only the first human being to die physically, but he died in reference to what he had given to God. That is, he died in reference to his faith. He obeyed what God had commanded regarding sacrifice. His brother Cain did not. And in the envy and jealousy of his brother being rejected and Abel being approved, Abel suffered the ultimate fate of the faithful. His brother killed him for his faith. In verse 13 of Hebrews chapter 11, Abraham is there under discussion. And he says in verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Abraham had these wonderful and magnificent promises that drove him forward to leave the security and the familiarity of his homeland and go out, God said, to a land I'll show you later. And what drove Abraham on to follow after the promise of God was his faith. And you notice he says they were assured and embraced the promises of God. But at the same time, they lived in the land of Canaan when Abraham finally came into the land with his extended family, including Lot and his family. When they came into the land, they continued to live in the land that had been given to him by promise as strangers and pilgrims. The land God promised to them actually belonged to somebody else. And how frustrating that would have been to Abraham to know that by right of divine promise, the land was his, but while others were living in cities behind protective walls, Abraham and his family continued to live in tents and to live a nomadic life. In verse 25, he's speaking of Moses, and he says, Moses chose to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Moses suffers. Abraham suffers. Abel gave the ultimate price for his faith in God, and that was his life. What drove all of these people on? Well, in verse 10 of Hebrews 11, it says that Abraham waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Abraham, though the promises were rooted in the possession of the land of Canaan, whereby his descendants would grow and develop into a great nation from whom the Messiah would eventually come. Abraham placed so much of his life here on the earth in those promises, but that's not where his ultimate hope was. He was looking for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He wasn't looking at Jericho, and he wasn't looking at Salem, and he wasn't looking at Hebron, and he wasn't looking at all the other cities in Canaan and placing all of his hope there. But he kept looking to the reward that would come from God. In verse 16, they desire a better, that is a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, and He has prepared a city for them. In verse 15, he said, you know, Abraham always had the choice of turning around and going back home. He had the choice of turning around and going back to Ur. And he didn't do that because he kept a spiritual outlook. And these ancestors of Abraham are figuratively about to turn and go back to Ur. And thus, they're not demonstrating the same kind of faith Abraham had. In verse 26, Moses esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. Again, a spiritual outlook. In verse 35, women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting the deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Throughout the theme in chapter 11 of all these great men and women of old who suffered for God is also woven this thread of they were looking spiritually. They were looking beyond the present suffering, beyond the present circumstances, to what God was offering to them spiritually and in heaven. And so, in chapter 12 and verse 1, he looks back at all of this gallery of faithful people in chapter 11, and he calls them a great cloud of witnesses. That is, their ancestry are witnesses, basically, I think, to two things. Number one, faith in God often brings hardship. And number two, that faith is always rewarded in the end. So he says, go back and consider your ancestors that you venerate, that you honor, that you adore, and that you worship. All these people who you claim to be their descendants, and you claim that they were great people. Well, go back and think about their faith. Did God pave the way in front of them? Did God make everything easy for them? No, but they endured because they kept looking at God. They kept considering God to be faithful, even when, as we might say, the going got tough. Well, then he says in chapter 12, verses 2 and 3, after looking backwards at the men and women of the patriarchal and the Mosaic age, men and women of faith, he then says in chapter 12 and verses 2 and 3, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider Him who endured such hostility from sinners against Himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Earlier in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10, the writer had said it was fitting for God, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. And now in chapter 12, he tells these people to look to Jesus. That is, in the language of verses 1 and 2, they're running a race, a marathon. And he's saying, don't look at the hill that's in front of you. Look beyond that to the finish line. Get your eyes off of your present circumstance and look to God. Again, this is what the hardships of life tend to do. They take our view off of God and place it onto ourselves, and before long, we're singing, woe is me, woe is me. Nobody's had it as bad as I've got it. And he says to them, oh, really? He says, you've not resisted yet to bloodshed in verse 4, chapter 12. You've not shed blood yet for your faith. But he talked in chapter 11 about men who had been sawn in half for their faith. But ultimately, he says, look to Jesus. He endured shame, the cross, the suffering that came with that, hostility from sinners, again, as James is reading to us, an innocent man absolutely despised and rejected and thought unworthy even to live. And Jesus endured all of that. And so he says, look to your ancestors and their faith, but ultimately look to Jesus. But with that as a foundation, what he's really saying and what he's building up to is the verses that we find next, and that's verses 5 through 11. Look to God. And look to Him as a faithful and loving Heavenly Father. You know, when we look to Jesus, it spoke again in verses 2 and 3 about what Jesus endured. But when we're going through trials and hardships, we might compare ourselves to Jesus and say, yeah, but He didn't do anything to deserve that. I wonder if I have done something. So we begin to look at our circumstance, we begin to look at our trials, and we begin to wonder, is it something I did? Is this punishment? Is God trying to punish me for something? Do I deserve this that's happening to me? Or is it just one of those circumstances in life that comes to everybody? And God intends for me to learn from it, but it's not necessarily that I'm at fault in some way. And this is where I think the trials of life begin to be difficult for us. We want an explanation. Lord, tell me why I'm going through this. I need to know the reason why. And so when we look to Jesus, we see that certainly He was innocent, deserving of nothing, by way of rebuke from God. But what about me? Am I going through these trials because of something I've done? Or even worse, is somebody I love going through a trial because of something I've done? And those can become very, very unsettling questions in this life. Well, let's look at what the writer says here in trying to bring them back to a proper understanding of God. Number one, he makes the point in verse 9 of chapter 12 that what God is doing for... I'm sorry, that's verse 6. For whom the Lord loves, He chastens and scourges every son whom He receives. The principle of love and rebuke is tied together here by the writer of Hebrews. And he's saying it's out of love a father chastens his son. And so he says when you look at God, you need to cultivate a father and son view of Him. He says in verse 5, you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. And then he quotes from Proverbs chapter 3. And he speaks of God chastening those whom He loves. He says, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by Him. This kind of discipline grows out of God's love for us. It's just simply a fact of human life that we need a disciplined oversight to help us overcome the weaknesses of satisfaction and complacency and taking things for granted, being unmotivated, as we talked about last Sunday. We tend to want to settle down to a comfortable place and not be budged from that. And then beyond that, we begin to congratulate ourselves for this nice, comfortable place that we're in because of what we've done to achieve it. And we just simply tend to drift into that frame of mind over and over again. And so we need discipline. And we need correction. And we need hardship to make us, as we said at the beginning of the lesson, think all over again about ourselves and about the nature of life and about God. When we're going through whatever the trial of life may be, let me ask you to imagine something and how you would respond. I'm in the middle of a trial. I'm in the middle of great difficulty. I'm agonizing over my circumstance. Suppose God were to say to you, so you could hear it. Jim, I know exactly what you're going through. I'm aware of it completely. I'll give you everything you need to endure it. At the end of the day, you're going to come out better. Keep holding on. Suppose God said that so I could hear it. What would I be unwilling then to endure if I knew, whether God explained the full nature of the circumstance to me or not, but I knew God knew? Would we not receive a tremendous amount of strength simply knowing that God is aware of what I'm going through? Whether He solved the problem or He just said, I'll get you through it, and He doesn't alleviate it. Part of the agony I think that we go through mentally and emotionally and even spiritually when we're dealing with the hardships of life is at the root of it an uncertainty about God's role in the whole thing. And what the Hebrew writer is saying is God loves you like a father loves his son. And He knows that we all grow and develop and mature in our faith by hardship. I wish it were not that way, but I'll tell you what, it's true with me. You answer that for yourself, but it's true with me. I learn a whole lot more out of failures and flaws and hardships that create difficulty for me than I learn out of successes and triumphs. I think that's probably true for most of us. And so He says, you've forgotten something. You have forgotten the exhortation that speaks to you as sons. Thus quoting Proverbs at the third chapter. The second principle that we find here is that meaningful discipline is painful. Chapter 12 and verse 11, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but grievous. And that's not only from a punishment standpoint, but if you consider, as He's doing in the passage here, considering the human father and son relationship. Do we not, should we not, as fathers, establish some parameters, some discipline parameters for our children so that we are teaching them and they are growing and developing? Like setting rules to be obeyed and followed, chores to be done around the house, studies to be engaged in so that our children are being educated properly. Yes, including punishment when the boundaries are broken, especially with a rebellious or an apathetic attitude toward parental discipline. But the point is, there's all kinds of things that we as human fathers will implement, not merely punishment, but rules and regulations and directions and expectations that are to a child painful. They'd much rather do what they want to do than clean up the house. It's painful to go through the duties and to fulfill them in a way that our parents approve of the job that we've done. But through those kinds of painful expectations, including chastisement, our children are being bettered. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. And so there's reward in the pain. Being what we are as human beings, there's reward in the pain. Back in verse 9, shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? What is He saying? Through the discipline, the chastening of God, life results. Spiritual life results. In verse 10, they indeed, our human fathers, for a few days, chastened us as seemed best to them, but He for our profit, that we may be partakers of His holiness. So there's profit and reward and being a partaker of God's holiness through these difficult circumstances of life that come. And so He's trying again to reinstill within them confidence in God, faithfulness of God, love of God. But even after having said the things that we've said about these circumstances, there still, I think, tends to be rattling around in the back of our brain somewhere. Yeah, but still, I need to know. I need to know whether or not I'm in this specific circumstance I'm in because of something I've done? Is it chastening? Or is it just one of those purifying trials of life? And we tend still to want to agonize over this question. How can we know? Well, I don't think we can know. The true nature and purpose of what unfortunate circumstance has befallen us in life without specific revelation. And we're not going to have that. There are times in the past where there was directly tied to some kind of a trial or hardship an explanation of why. Miriam was stricken with leprosy immediately after she challenged the leadership of her brother Moses. Korah's rebellion. The earth opens up and swallows the rebellious family. There's quite obviously clear cause and effect there. The child that was produced adulterously with David and Bathsheba, the child's life was taken, as God said would happen. Paul understood that whatever his thorn in the flesh was, it was there because God allowed it to be to keep him humble. Throughout the Old Testament, there are various plagues and catastrophes and wars that came upon the people of God as punishment and chastisement for what they had done sinfully. Yet, I think those are the exceptions. I think more often than not, throughout history and certainly today, when people suffer, they do so without the benefit of that divine insight, explaining specifically, yes, Jim, you're going through this because A or B or C. Most famously, we have Job, who never had an explanation given to him of what kind of a challenge had been made about his faith. But what God did with Job is what the Hebrew writer is doing with the Hebrews. God led Job back to himself, not to an explanation. And at the end of the day, he reinvigorated Job's faith in him, in God. He did not give him the satisfaction of an explanation. Which leads me then to conclude, we do not need to know the specific cause of our pain in order for it to be beneficial. What we need is confidence in God Himself. That means I'm going to examine my life when hardship comes. I'm not likely to do it in success. I'm likely to be patting myself on the back for that. It's not until hardship comes that I'm going to have those dark nights, that I'm going to find a quiet place to sit down and I'm going to start reflecting on who is Jim? And what kind of a life is he living? And I've got this hardship that's come into my life. Is this a mistake that I've made? Did I bring this on myself? Did I contribute to this circumstance being here? Is there something God is trying to get through to me by allowing me to go through this? Do I have weaknesses I need to be working on? You know what? The answer to those questions is always yes. There are things about me I need to be working on. Thus, whether it's a circumstance specifically sent by God or not, there's benefit in it. Most of the time when we sit down in a quiet place and we examine ourselves, we can find things that need to be improved, that need to be changed, where we need to grow. Especially is that true in times of pain and difficulty. So there must be an ongoing desire on our part to examine ourselves and to do so honestly. But at the same time, I don't think it's right to assume that our problem must be caused by some fault. I must be going through this because I'm totally unworthy. I'm totally weak and I'm flawed and I deserve everything that I get. Sometimes it's just life. It's time and chance, as the writer of Ecclesiastes says. Sometimes it's just we need to go deeper in our faith. Not that we have a glaring weakness like David having committed adultery and then murder and trying to hide that. But even when we examine ourselves like Job and we can say, I know I'm not a perfect man, but I don't see anything that I've done to bring this kind of horror upon myself. There are times we can do that, and we can have confidence in the life that we're living. Not to say that we're perfect, but we're not hiding any horrible thing, any sinful frame of mind that we're reveling in inwardly, and outwardly we're trying to keep everybody else from seeing it. It's not always true. Sometimes we examine ourselves and say, I'm not aware of a great matter of transgression in my life. Yet it might be that simply by those difficulties, God is wanting me to go deeper in my faith and dig more deeply below the surface and ask some of those questions about Him or about ourselves and our purpose in being here or about other people. You know, it's not until we go through some of those hardships that we can genuinely have an interest in other people and sympathize with them and sit with them and hold their hand and not really say anything but just be there. And the person can understand that we're there holding their hand because we've been there. Sometimes that's something very valuable to be learned by the hardships of life. Whether we see in our difficulties and in our pain, whether we see a glaring moral or spiritual fault that needs to be corrected, or whether we just simply look to our purpose in being in this world, and look to the heavenly rewards that God is holding out before us. There is profit, there is gain, there is benevolence. So God has ordered things that come out of the trials and the difficulties of life. When we look at our lives and see that there's issues that need correction, let's be thankful for that. Be thankful for the trial that reached out through my complacency and grabbed me by the throat and gave me a good shake and said, Jim, think about it. Think about your life and think about what needs to be improved and corrected. Be thankful that I've had opportunity to come to my senses and to escape the snare of the devil, as Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 2. As we close our thoughts, I'd like to point you to the outlook of Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. The outlook that Paul had concerning, as we mentioned earlier, the thorn that was given to him to keep him humble. We don't know what the difficulty was. We don't know the source of his pain or discomfort. It's not stated in the Scriptures, perhaps intentionally, so that we might all be able to relate to Paul with whatever we may be going through. But Paul, whatever it was so unpleasant, Paul wanted it removed. And he prayed 3 times that God would remove it. And God graciously answered Paul and said, Paul, let me tell you, here's the reason that I'm going to continue to let you be afflicted by this. Verse 7 of 2 Corinthians 12, lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Nonetheless, he says in verse 8, I pleaded for that to be removed. And the answer of the Lord to him was, my grace is sufficient for you, Paul. That is, I'm not taking it away, but I'm going to give you everything you need to endure it. Now, I asked you earlier to imagine that if the Lord were to say to you in the midst of your trial, Jim, I'm aware, and I'm going to let it remain, how much more courage we would have and strength and resolve to deal with that? Well, that's what Paul had. He had a confirmation from the Lord that there was a purpose behind that suffering. And look at what it does for Paul's outlook. In verse 9, therefore I most gladly will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I'm weak, then am I strong. Notice this. The Lord said, I'm not going to take away the thorn. I'm going to leave the thorn there. But Paul goes beyond that. Whatever the thorn is, we don't know. But he then goes on in verse 10 and says, I take pleasure in every difficulty and trial. I take pleasure in infirmities, reproaches, needs, persecutions, distresses. That goes beyond the thorn, whatever that was. What Paul says is really the point of this lesson that I think we need to try to come away with. What Paul says is, it's really about confidence in God and God's ability to bring circumstances to bear in our lives that bring our thinking back to Him over and over and over. We're led back to God. And we're led back to trust in Him. Remember to the Hebrews, God is not unfaithful to forget. He's not unaware of what you're going through. He'll give you everything you need, and that might be hardship. It might be trial. But what's the objective? To just go through life not feeling pain? Isn't the objective to go through life drawing closer to God? And pain does that. Trial does that. And really, at the end of the day, you're not going to avoid it. It's all going to depend on how you look at it. And Paul says, I take pleasure in those things. Because when I come to confront within myself that this is not of me, and it's not of my strength, it's not of my wisdom, it's not of my knowledge, it's not how great I am, when life beats me down and confronts me with that unavoidable conclusion, then the only thing I'm left with is it must be of God. It must be God working in my life. And thus the relationship with God is strengthened by trial and hardship. So if you're waiting for the answer, you know, as to why the things happen to us in life, incident by incident, I'm sorry to tell you, I don't think the answer is there. We're not going to see the answer to that in the trial itself. It's not going to explain itself that way. What we're left with is faith. Faith that God loves me as a father loves his son. And whatever I endure in this life, it's going to make me stronger with God's help. Whatever I deal with in this life, the outcome is going to be much better for me than if I had not faced it. It's that kind of an outlook that enables us to deal with trial and tribulation, not an explanation of where it's coming from or why it's there. It may be that somebody's here this morning with some of those dark clouds hovering around your life. It may be that you're here in the midst of trial and difficulty and pain in some way, and it's caused you to question the goodness of God and His interest in you. I hope that something we said this morning might point you to His faithfulness and His goodness and His love, and that you will not let Satan take these incidents in life and turn you against God and embitter your soul against Him. God is looking out for us like a father's looking out for his children, and that means difficulty, that we might grow and improve. If you desire to respond to the Lord, to come to Him and to be His child and put your faith and confidence wholly in Him and in His Son, Jesus Christ, who's the sacrifice for all of our sins, the opportunity now is made available to you. If we can help you in any other way spiritually, would you come as we stand and sing?